Okay, Bill, you ready?
All right. Well, good evening, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you all doing?
Hi, Sandy.
And I want to welcome everybody back. If you're here for the first time, I've mentioned this every week as sort of a disclaimer that this is not a workshop on the 12 steps, and this is not a how to do it. So if anything you pick up here and you're talking with your sponsor and he sees it differently or she sees it differently, you go along with your sponsor. I'm here to have some fun. I've been around AA a long time and I got a lot of stories. And so we tell stories and try to have fun. And I try to make them applicable to the principles involved in each of the steps that we're talking about. And I'm getting so old that I have to make notes. I left a whole bunch of history out last time. And so I brought them along and said, I've never done that. It's a big blow to my ego to have to use notes. Drives me crazy. But you'll have to put up with it. But anyway, I had some people tell me that they've never heard my story. And they don't know who they're talking to. You know, who is this guy? Is he really an alcoholic? And so I don't have time to tell my stories, but I did bring a collection of slides. And we'll just run through them real quick. And I think at the end of, see, your picture's worth a thousand words. And so we'll just run through these, and you'll probably get a good idea of type of guy that I am. So if we can turn on the first one. Now that's a shot of me before I became an alcoholic. And I want you to notice how well I stand up, how close people stand to me, and how clear and blue my eyes are. This is several years later after I became an alcoholic. You'll notice I'm having quite a problem standing. And there's no one within 25 feet of me. And my eyes are missing. So, now, this is very unusual that somebody would have a camera handy when you're having your first drink, but this is actually me taking my first drink. This is a shot of me losing my first drink. And, for those of you that aren't alcoholics, when I say I lost the drink, I don't mean I don't know where it is. I mean I no longer have possession of it. So moving ahead rather quickly, here's a shot of me throwing up in prep school. Here's a shot of me throwing up at Yale. Here's a shot of me after I became a fighter pilot in the Marine Corps throwing up in an oxygen mask. That is something you want to avoid if you can. A lot of you may not know, but the microphone is in the oxygen mask. Sometimes I would hear from the tower something like this. Dixieland 5-3, this is at Tsugi Tower. You're breaking up. Please repeat all after leaving 40,000 feet. This is 1957. It's a landmark year because until I got sober and had about 25 years, this is the first time I ever had a brand new car. And this is me driving out of the lot in my brand new car. Here I am picking up a hitchhiker in my brand new car. Here's the hitchhiker sticking me up in my brand new car. Here's the hitchhiker driving off in my brand new car. Here's a shot of me hitchhiking. Here's a shot of the hitchhiker picking me up in my brand new car. Luckily, she didn't recognize me. So. Okay, moving ahead real fast. Here's a shot of my children and my wife turning their back on me. Here's a shot of my parents turning their back on me. Here's a shot of the Marine Corps turning its back on me. Here's a shot of me having a grand mal seizure and ending up in the nut ward. Here's a shot about 6 days later when I went completely wacko and they caught me and they're putting me in this straitjacket. As you can see, they didn't have my size. I take a 42 long and that's a 38 regular, as you can see. When things go bad, they really go bad. This is after I got in Alcoholics Anonymous, and it's a shot of me eagerly working the steps with my sponsor. I don't know why, but he always kept his military pistol on the table when we were working the steps. This is 10 years later. It's a shot of me smiling. 20 years later, a shot of me smiling. All the rest of the shots are just shots of me smiling, and it's been that way ever since. So there, I hope the slideshow gave you a little bit of an appreciation that I really am an alcoholic. Leaving 40,000 feet. Ah, yeah.
I understand.
Okay, we were... We spend maybe the next 15, 20 minutes or so talking about some of the history. And we basically were doing the 30s, the 40s, and the 50s this time, and then the 60s next week, which you'll understand why it's important to me next week. That's when I arrived. Anyway, as the 40s came to an end, Ann Smith died, and we always like to mention Ann, who was Dr. Bob's wife, because she is given great credit by Bill and a lot of the old-timers for being the one who really was a spiritual leader, who developed a lot of the readings, who just kept everybody on course. She was a very stabilizing influence on all of the early alcoholics. Also, Jack Alexander wrote a second article in the Saturday Evening Post, and this was, we mentioned the first one. The second one was to go back to AA 9 years later and take a look, and he really does a wonderful job of showing all the pluses and some of the little problems that AA groups have. But again, it was a remarkably positive publicity about AA, which is our program of attraction, not promotion. We let other people say all the good things about AA, and AA doesn't do that. We just help drunks. And the rest just takes care of itself, which is kind of what a spiritual life is. We just do God's work, and he takes care of everything else. It's very hard to get to that point because our ego doesn't want to be cut out of the picture. But certainly that article helped us to see that. Dr. Silkworth passed away, and of course we talked about him. He wrote The Doctor's Opinion, and he was very crucial in Bill Wilson getting sober and Towns Hospital, etc. They had the first General Service Conference in New York, and it was the first time they got organized as AA as a whole. And after the conference, Lois and a few other women went up to Stepping Stones, which is where the Wilsons lived, and made the plans that became the foundation of Al-Anon. And so you can see it was a very few people were responsible for all these things that we have down to this day. In 53, the 12 and 12 was published. I graduated from college that year. I think they were studying me because that was the years that Yale University was studying alcoholism. And they were the original university that was studying it, and then it went on to Rutgers, and I don't know where it is now, but that was the origin where they were just trying to get a handle on this, and Dr. Jelinek came along, and some people who went to treatment in the old days remember the Jelinek curve where it goes all the way to the bottom, and then you come to AA and you see it come all the way back up. Then we had the 20th anniversary in St. Louis, and they had 5,000 people. So you can see the increase in the numbers of our international conventions. So at the end of 20 years, we have 5,000, and I forget what they had in Toronto, 65,000 or something like that. So you can see how much bigger AA is and how it continues to just blossom. Now the last thing, and then they also published AA Comes of Age, and the second edition of the Big Book. Now, the second edition of the Big Book, this is the third edition, but the second edition had a cover very similar to this, only it was, and that was the one I had. It came out in 55, and I came in 64, so everybody had second editions then. And the unique feature about the second edition was it had a reversible cover. So you could take the cover off the book, and the back of it was the same color, blue. And then you could put that on, and nobody would know what the name of the book was that you were reading as you were sitting on a bus. You follow what I'm saying? It was to protect people from knowing, you know, that we were in AA in case that bothered us. Also, in 54, and you'll see it on here, AA adopted the circle and the triangle. And it appeared on all the pamphlets. It was the official symbol of AA. And for whatever reason, in 1994, they took it off. Now, I'm going to try and find out. Maybe one of the delegates is here, and they can tell me why they did that. But it doesn't appear now. But it's still, we talk about the circle and the triangle as if it were still there. Okay, so that gets us through the 40s and 50s. And leaves me plenty of time to get back to our discussion of the steps, or in my, what I'm trying to do is to talk about stories. And as you know, we've been using one analogy to carry us through, and that was the slide projector. And for those of you that are new, we came up with this because we've learned through bitter experience that it's impossible to achieve happiness by trying to control the world out there, or the world on the screen, if it were a slide projector. But that's what we were taught to do when we were little. They said, take a look, you got to succeed in that world, and you've got to accomplish this and all that. So our eyes and our focus were always out there to see what's going on, who's getting ahead of us, what's the problem. And as a result, we saw lots of problems because there were other people trying to get the same stuff we were trying to get, because we were convinced that that's where happiness lay, in getting that screen arranged to suit me. And we came into AA and we said, wait a minute. If you're a slide projector and you don't like what's up on the screen, why are you walking up to the screen trying to move all the images around? Why don't we come back into the booth, the projection booth, and see if we can change the slides, and then see if the picture up there doesn't become more pleasing? And that was exactly what we were talking about as we inventoried in the fourth step. Well, what are all these slides that I keep projecting up there that cause me great fear, anxiety, anger, envy, lust, whatever it is? And they They are repeated all the time. Everybody has their own pet set of slides. Everybody has their own pet set of problems. In other words, somebody over here worries all the time they're going to fall off a cliff. Nobody on this side is even remotely worried about something like that. They're worried about not having enough money or not getting as much attention as someone else does. Or whatever it is, we find that we repeat this stories in these slides that we started putting together when we were young, and we just keep playing them. Well, there I am, not adequate, just like 10 years ago. Yeah, there I am. Not much, huh? There it is. You come back in 15 years. Well, let's put a slide of you up there. Yeah, there I am. Still a piece of crap. It's been that way since I was... I got to go up and fix that. I'm going to go put some good clothes on that person. I'm going to run up there and get the makeup done a little bit better. Well, now I'm a piece of crap with good makeup on. It hasn't changed anything because we got to come back and see what's wrong with these slides. And we talked about the fact that how are these slides made? They're made by thinking. All problems are created solely by thinking. That's how every problem we have is created, by thinking. It is not that I got fired. That's an event. I didn't have anything to do about it. And it's not a problem because I will go look for another job. The problem is I'm very angry that I got fired because it's threatening me and I'm frightened. That's the problem. How did I get that problem? Oh, I just thought it up. I said, I'm very frightened that I got fired. Well, did the boss come in and say, you're fired and you're frightened? He didn't say that. He just said, you're fired. We're cutting back. We're not doing enough business. So I, my slide maker, which is my ego, goes, yay, here's a chance to generate some more trouble. And I just start thinking about it. And you know the pattern. We can make about 15 slides out of that. Well, I won't have any health insurance. Then when I get sick, I won't be able to afford the doctor. So any small sickness will soon turn into a big sickness. Probably get malnutrition. I can't afford food. I'll be slowly starving to death. And you miss two payments on the mortgage, they take the house. I read the fine print in there, so now I have malnutrition on the streets. You haven't got home yet from being fired. This is the... And as you all know, we could go on forever over all kinds of events that happen. And so the reason that we have sponsors and have these steps is to allow somebody else to see what's going on. And they come into the booth and they go, wait a minute, all that happened is you've been fired. You made up all the rest of this stuff. We got to get rid of this. We're going to take this one out, this one out, this one out. And that's the wonderful thing of not trying to see anything on our own. This is one of the great lessons of the fifth step. The truth about ourselves requires a third dimension. It was like when I was flying photo missions. We would take two pictures very close of the same thing. It would be like a 70% overlap. So that when they got the photos back, they could put them like this. And then when they looked in, they saw the third dimension and they could measure how deep craters were, how deep trenches were, and how high something else was. And that's what another person, in most cases our sponsor, does. It puts things in perspective. And so we learn this by inviting someone into the booth, into the projection booth. And we find out that the way to make the picture so that it's the most comfortable thing in the world is to remove all the slides. All of the slides, because they are simply my mind's reaction to all the events I've ever had. The events aren't up there. It's my reaction to the events. You follow what I'm saying? It's that event happened. Oh, yes. That's the most outrageous thing that ever happened to me. Do you see what I'm saying? It just happened. Wasn't outrageous to anyone else. It's the most outrageous. And so spirituality occurs not by learning anything. It occurs by unlearning, by undoing what we have put together that really isn't real. It's our entire existence of ideas which we put inside ourselves that were nothing more than reactions to something that happened. And then we create an entire story based on the reactions. And in that world, which becomes just a show business world, there's no God. And it gets very lonely. Loneliness, authors have been writing about human loneliness since almost the beginning of time. That how do you deal with the realization that you're actually, when you really cut through it all alone here? Well, we're all alone because we made up a story that we're all alone. We're the only ones in it. It's just like a dream. Did you ever have a dream that you weren't in? And the same with these stories. All of the stories, if each one of us got up and shared all the slides, we would be the star of every slide. Just like the ones I just showed you. Here I am throwing up. Here I am blah, blah, blah. And if we went inside of each of us with our thinking, you would go, oh yeah, that's the time I. Maybe they're positive ones. That's the time I scored a touchdown. And everybody went, yay! So that all I want to do is go back and play that one slide. There they are. They're still applauding. I know, but you're 58. I know, but I like playing that slide. Makes me feel wonderful to play that slide. And so as we discussed the possibility in the sixth step of getting rid of every slide, or as the step says, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. What is a character defect? It's a slide. It's a wrong story. It is not true. If we could ever get willing to have these slides erased, then, as we talked about last week, when we turn the projector on, the only thing that'll come out is pure white light, which is our true nature. That is our Creator shining through us. And when that light appears on the outside world, it illumines it the way it's supposed to be, and we see people in an entirely different manner. And when they are bathed in that light, which is what you feel when you come to AA, I don't know what's going on here, but it feels good. You're feeling some of this spiritual energy. You're feeling concern from other people with nothing in return for them. And it makes you feel entirely different. So instead of being self-centered alcoholics, which we've been all our lives, and our specialty is bringing out the worst in people, which we're all very good at. You know what I'm talking about? We had a plane and we landed somewhere to get it fixed, and we were there about 5 days, some little peaceful town out in Iowa. And I think that town is probably still recovering from that. You know, they were there fighting with each other, and because we were able to bring out the worst in those people. And that's what we do. We just, give me that. I don't understand. Let me talk to the manager. I mean, just, you know, the... That's because that's what's being played. This place is unfair. You see what I'm saying? They rip you off in here. Where did that slide come from? There's a bunch of people over here that think it's wonderful. Oh, no, it's not. They rip you off. They rip you off. Where did that come from? I don't know, but it's there. I can see it. I can see it. I'm projecting it up there, so when I see a place that rips me off, which I created, then I emotionally react to it. God, I'm getting ripped off. You see what I'm saying? I rip myself off, and then I go, God, I feel terrible about getting ripped off here. And it's just astounding the emotional reaction that we have to erroneous thoughts. And that's why this trusting your feelings is a tough one in the spiritual world. Because a lot of those are caused by our own thinking, which isn't true. So that's why we run them by someone else. I'm feeling this way. Well, get rid of it. It's not true. Oh, thank you. You follow what I'm saying? And our sponsors can see that. Or they can say, well, now that I'd be concerned about. You see what I'm saying? And that's why we never try to evaluate ourselves on our own. And these are the great principles that come out of the steps 5 and 6 and 7. They're huge steps. Now, when that light shines on people, it brings out the best in them. Brings out the very best in them. And when you finish your day, you come home and you go, God, I had a great day. And we have no idea that we caused it. The light just went around having people respond to it. Hi. I mean, you know, it's just, that's what happens. Just a smile sometimes, and you'll see what happens in a dry cleaning place or something like that. Hey, good day. Thanks for your show. Oh, God, I always love coming in here. And then they go, oh, really? Wow, I love working in this place. See how powerful that is. So the light itself is the solution. Now, here's the problem. The problem is trying to get all the slides becoming willing to have them all gone, because that wouldn't leave much of me. You know what I mean? Me. There would be really no me. There'd be like just God talking through me. I'd be like a damn little puppet. You know what I mean? Hi, I'm Sandy. God's talking through me. How are you all doing tonight? That would be terrible, right? Wrong. Wouldn't that be wonderful? We'd just be an instrument. And we'd see everything the way our Creator sees it. And we wouldn't make up any stories about anything. We would just be. That would be the end of it. So it's quite a struggle to become entirely willing to have all of these removed. You know, when we talk about freedom and we were slaves to so many things, alcohol and sex and drugs and gambling and you name it. And if we looked at it like a person who was tied to a tree with ropes of varying length, and maybe there's 15 ropes, and you finally get the first one loose, so now you can go 3 feet away from the tree. Well, you're freer than you were. You know what I mean? And then you cut another one. Now I'm 10 feet. Well, now I got the whole 10 feet to walk around. But until you get that last one cut, you're really not free. You know what I mean? I'm more free than I used to be, because now I'm 150 feet. I can walk all around this tree, but there's still that one. Now, those were placed there by some outside source. But we're going to come over and it's going to be the exact flip side of that. We're going to try and surrender all the ropes that we put. And the way the ropes work are, I got a death grip on it and I ain't letting it go. No, I'm not giving this up yet. And I'm going to tell them, I give up drinking. I gave up drinking. I told you about my sponsors. I can't drink. Okay. So AA is a not drinking organization. And then he said, you know, you're taking money down at work, that's embezzling, you got to stop. Oh, you got to not drink and not embezzle. So there's two things you do in here. You remember that? And then, you know, if you're going to have a happy marriage, you're going to have to knock off the affairs. Oh, so there's three things in AA. No embezzling, no drinking, no affairs. And then it goes on and on and on until I've let go of everything. So in the same vein that if there's still one rope holding me from being free, there's still one clenched fist holding me from being surrendered. Turning my life over. God, you got everything except these 12. I'm going to hang on to these for a while. I'm not throwing this little black book away. Maybe when I'm 80. Whatever it is that we don't want to give up. And so the sixth step is talking about perfection. And there's a story that C.S. Lewis came up with that I just think is wonderful. He's one of my favorite authors because he makes up stories. That's how he teaches. And I've told this story a lot, so if those of you who have been around, bear with me. But it's a quick one. But it's about the little boy with the toothache. And the story is that he's in grammar school. He's on the baseball team. They're going into the championship. And the coach says, guys, we've discussed everything. There's nothing left. No more practice. Nothing. Go home. Eat a wonderful meal and go to bed and get 8 hours sleep. If you get 8 hours sleep, we're going to beat them. Guaranteed. That's all you guys need. Just rest. So he went home, told his mother, had the dinner, went to bed. He's sound asleep, and about midnight, he wakes up with the beginning of a little toothache. And he feels it, and he says to himself, if I call my mother, she'll bring two aspirin in. The aspirin will take away that little bit of pain that I have, and I'll go right back to sleep. But he doesn't call his mother. He decides to wait and see if it'll go away by itself. And he waits and he waits and he's feeling, oh, now it's getting a little stronger. You know how toothaches when they start? And so now he's totally focused on feeling the tooth. Well, nothing so far. Okay. He waits 2 hours. Finally calls his mother. She gives him the aspirin. He goes to sleep and he gets up, but he missed about 3 hours sleep, so he makes three errors and the team loses. And the question is, why would he wait 3 hours before getting the aspirin? And that has to do very much with step six. The reason he didn't call is that he knew his mother, and he knew she would run right in and get him the aspirin and he'd go back to sleep. But she wouldn't stop there. The next day, she would call the dentist for an appointment for him to go in to have this tooth looked at. And he knew the dentist, that when you got there, the dentist would look at that tooth, but he would also look at all the other teeth in your head. And if he found some other problems, there would be a series of appointments until you had perfect teeth. He didn't want perfect teeth, he just wanted two aspirin. The only help that was available was perfect help. And if you notice who we're contacting in the sixth step, it's the supplier of perfect help, God. We're entirely willing to have God remove all the defects of character. You think he's going to remove them partway? Partway? Gets rid of 90% of lust? I think he's going to take the other 10. That's going a little too far, like we talked about last week. So we can see that this is the beginning, as the 12 and 12 suggests, of a lifetime job of trying to get willing now about these. Now we come to the shortest step in the program. Humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. And if we look in the big book, I have the seven-step prayer right on this little card. The entire seventh step says, we now said something like this. My Creator, I am now willing that you should have all of me, good and bad. So there it is, all. I mean, if the prayer says it, it says everything that has to be said. I pray that you now remove from me every single defect of character which stands in the way of my usefulness to you and my fellows. And make no mistake about it, that's all of them. I remember telling myself, well, the reason I'm still a complete ass in these other nine areas, God doesn't want them to go yet. Because they're not in the way of my being useful. Grant me strength as I go out from here to do your bidding. Amen. We've now completed step seven. Until you read the 12 and 12, which came out in 1953, which is quite a few years later. And I think Bill realized that this indeed said it all, but it didn't say it strong enough. It, as he was working on the original six principles from the Oxford group, it left some wiggle room. You know what I mean? And it left us, I'm all done. This is it. Just take everything. Thank you. I'm on to step eight. So the spirit was there. It was perfectly clear. But as you see when he writes the 12 and 12, it's more than most people see. And I think he saw an additional dimension as he put together the seventh step. It's totally about humility. And humility is a very misunderstood word. It is a word that has a hard time of it in our society. You never see a car ad, buy this car, people will call you humble. It's just not, oh, isn't he great, he's so humble. You ought to hire him, really humble. Probably sell everybody. See that lineman over there? Look at him. Isn't he humble? He said, we need more humble football players, and then we'll be able to really have a winning season. Humble seems to mean wimpy, weak. At least that's what I thought it was. Humble, humble. I thought, what is humble? And so when I got to this thing, and my sponsor said, now you see this step? I said, yep. Humbly asked them to remove our shortcomings. Okay, well, you know what the shortcomings are. They're the defects of character. Yep. Okay. All you have to do is humbly ask God to remove them. I said, okay, yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And he said, well, how are you going to do it? Before you do it, would you explain to me the difference between just regular asking and humbly asking? Like regular asking. Hey, God, would you get rid of these? Okay, that's regular asking. Now, how do you humbly ask? And I thought to myself, and I remember a movie, I think it was Going My Way with Bing Crosby, and there was a nun in there. And every time you saw her, she was up in her room getting ready to pray, and the light was a certain way off of the mirror, and it captured her face, and I officially recorded it as humble. So I thought if I got up in my room in front of the mirror and looked in, and got that look, God, please take everything that I would be humbly asking. Now, maybe you did a lot better. But I haven't seen too many papers on humility, longer than one sentence or so. So it's a word that isn't really understood. And we say, well, if you think you have it, it's gone. And, you know, we have a lot of funny sayings about it. But let's look what Bill writes. I copied down a couple of them. He says, humility is the foundation principle of all of our 12 steps. How about that? Without some degree of humility, no alcoholic can stay sober at all. So we must have got some humility when we came in here. Then he goes on to say, as long as we play self-reliance, and then he said, unless we get more humility, we will never have a chance of becoming happy. Those are pretty big words, aren't they? No humility, no happiness. Wow. As long as we place self-reliance first, a genuine reliance upon a higher power was out of the question. The basic ingredient of all humility, a desire to seek and follow God's will for us, was missing. So we see there's a lot of humility in joining AA and saying, I can't stay sober on my own. I need help. And now we're in AA, and then they say, well, just admitting that you're an alcoholic isn't going to do it. You're going to have to go to lots of meetings in order to continue to live and stay sober. I don't want to go to meetings. I don't think I should have to do that. I don't think I like to do stuff all by myself. No, you go to meetings. All right, go to meetings. This is additional humility. We are making a statement. I am powerless over all this. And then they tell us to get a sponsor. And why do I need a sponsor? Because you can't rely on your thinking. What? I'm a genius. Whose thinking am I going to rely on? Anybody but you will move you ahead. Anybody but you. Well, you don't think that's a huge chunk of humility to rely on somebody else to do your thinking? We have a lot more humility than we realize. We are well on our way to erasing slides and becoming transparent so that this light can shine through us. So humility, I just made some notes here. I said, humility is the light. It is the absence of me. If I'm not there, everything shines through. I am the cloud between me and the sun. That's what I am. And if I can get that out of the way, things are going to be wonderful. So humility is, in fact, the light. It is the absence of self. And we see that as we start into AA. It's just that we get to a certain point and we're able to maintain a certain amount of sobriety and a certain level of semi-discomfort, and we call that success. Well, it is in the very beginning, but we don't want to go through the next 15, 20 years in 40% of the pain we used to be in and call that a win. You follow what I'm saying? They're going, don't settle for that. Keep going. Keep going. Humility, make me an instrument of thy will. There it summarizes it all right there. Humility allows the light to flow through because there's no self to block it. Of myself, I'm nothing. The light does the work in the slide projector. I'm nothing. God does the work. It's all let go and let God. Let go of what? Let go of all the clouds that are blocking the light. That's what we got to let go of. You're in the way of your life. Your story is in the way. Okay, well, I think you're convincing me. I think, okay, let's go. One more caveat. as the lawyers would say. Is there any lawyers here tonight? No, okay. This is the caveat about step seven. I hate to break the news to you, but erasing slides hurts. I mean, like, it hurts. Like, I don't like that. You remember how humiliating it was to be an alcoholic and finally admit, okay, I'm an alcoholic. So I was wrong. I am an alcoholic. First time my sponsor wanted me to say I'm wrong, I said, yes, you're right. And he said, no, you say you're wrong. I don't want to say I'm wrong. Being wrong is painful. Well, it turns out every one of those slides is wrong. Oh, yeah. You ready to start scraping? Oh, I don't know. So that's what... If we manage to become entirely willing, the process of removing old ideas is quite painful, page 72. For us, the process of gaining a new perspective was unbelievably painful. He certainly doesn't mince any words, does he? And we stick to it and clean a few slides, and we begin to feel peace of mind and serenity. And then he writes on page 74, our eyes begin to open to the immense value which comes straight out of painful ego puncturing. The tremendous value, which is more of the light, more peace of mind, more serenity, is now flowing in because I was willing. All right, we'll discuss gambling. All right. I got to change that. Oh, God, admit it's wrong. Okay, I'm willing to have it gone. And that's what we do here. We slowly go through what is called pain, but was later on called effort. Because as we realize every time that we experience this discomfort, that it makes us feel better later on, we start changing the name from pain to effort. It's like the first time you've been out of shape and you go to the gym to work out. Moving all those machines around, you remember how you feel after you go home? Every muscle in the body is dying. And you go, boy, it takes a lot of pain to get in shape. But as you get in shape, you're glad that you took the pain. All right, look at this. Hey, feeling better, breathing. I like this. What do you like? I like the fact that I went through that pain. But now we don't call it pain. We say, well, I got in shape and now I'm maintaining it. I think I'll even go further. I think I'll now try to run a marathon. I think I'll do this. I think I'll do that. And we suddenly see the immense value of what we once called suffering. Only we don't call it suffering anymore. And Bill writes that there comes a time when we voluntarily get humiliated. You follow what I'm saying? Instead of waiting for circumstances to rub our nose in it. We saw humility as something that was immensely desired. And so the seventh step is fitting in with perfection, which came out of the sixth step. And these are why you hear old-timers, been around a long time, the old folks home, well, what are you doing today? Six and seven. Which Chuck talked about in the tenth step, which is uncover, discover, discard. What else am I wrong about? What other slide did I suddenly find that is ruining the view? And I don't blame the view for being ruined on the outside world anymore. I don't go, God, my luck, of all those things, somebody put that up there, you know what I mean? I go, oh, that came from me. I can fix it in here. Call my sponsor. How can I get that gone? Ask that be removed. Do you see what I'm saying? It is totally a wonderful inside job. Then I don't know where these thoughts came, but I'll stick them in at the end because we got about five more minutes. I do a lot of writing to myself, and I wrote down something and said, I suddenly realize that I know a lot less than I used to know about 15 years ago. And of what I still think I know, I'm much less certain about it. And I think it's a step in the right direction. It's a step away from thinking that knowing is going to solve things. In the military, we had the need to know. I know you guys who were in the military, maybe other parts of the workplace have that. And you put on here, this document is available on a need-to-know basis only. And then there was, well, are you on the need-to-know list? No, you can't read it. So then we all wanted to be, well, I have a need-to-know. You know, with these freaking cell phones, if somebody finds something out 13 seconds ahead of you, you go, well, how come I wasn't told before the other guy? I want to be the first one to know what restaurant we're all going to go to. I don't want somebody else to know. And so there's this knowledge, and which is fine when you're trying to run a business and all those things, but in the spiritual world, it has nothing to do with being happy. Knowing and trying to know more doesn't help at all. What is comfortable is to be happy with not knowing and realize there isn't anything to know. There's just the light. And so I can be absolutely comfortable with not knowing. They say the greatest source of happiness would be to get rid of the need to know or wanting. So you get up and you never have the feeling inside, you know what I want? It never comes up. That's the same as getting everything. It's a spiritual flip side of getting everything. It's not wanting anything. You're 100% happy. You've solved the equation. Then the last point I was going to make is that spiritual teachers don't really teach us anything. They remind us of things that we forgot, that were already deep inside of us. We were born with all of our own truths. And as we go to meetings and we hear somebody say something and we resonate with it, it's because it's reawakening a truth inside of us. And I go, yeah. And then I go, you know, I already knew that somehow. I already knew that somehow. And so that's why we have that feeling. Wow, I think I knew that. And so actually, in the slide booth, we came in with all the truths we'd ever need, and those are the white lights. And then we made up additional truths, which was our story. Well, there's the truth, which came from my Creator, and then there's the stuff I added on. And that stuff became quite scary, and it also became reality. That's where I lived. That's where I spent my whole time. And that's what the 12th step is talking about, awakening. That's why when I started this whole thing, I started with the 12th step, that the point of the whole program is awakening. Awakening means we're now in touch with all these truths that were there to start with. People who have awakened, you know, Dalai Lama and some of those, I mean, totally awakened, the reaction that they have is, how could I have forgotten all this? My God, I can't believe I forgot all this. We didn't forget it. We went out and created reactions to events, and then we lived in the reactions, and that became home. And it's a scary place to be. It's very lonely in there because you're the only one that made the story up. So anyway, we're at the end of the time. And I want to thank you for your attention. I want to thank everybody for coming and the group for putting all this together. And that'll wrap it up, Bill, and we'll close the meeting with the Lord's Prayer for anybody who cares to join in.